Tell you as much as I can about cage theory in the little time we have left. So last time we talked about how principal bundles can be used when we put a connection on them to give us gauge fields. Now the next piece of the story is the curvature of a connection. So we're going to assume here we have a principal bundle and that omega, which is a one form on P with values in the algebra, is the connection. The curvature of the connection is a two-form, still valued in the Lie algebra, and we define it like this. As usual, these things are taken to be, if we are working in matrices, this is component-wise, taking the zero derivative, we need to define what this object is. So our problem is the following. We want to build a two-form out of a one-form. When we have one-forms, we know how to take them into a two-form in two ways. We can either do the zero derivative, or we can wedge them with something else. Because we have only one thing, the idea will be wedge W with itself, which indeed is what ends up happening. So eventually, this will actually be this object. And you might think, well, that doesn't make sense. If I take wedge of omega with omega, it should be zero. But it's not because these are matrices. So the way you should really think about this object here is if omega is written in a basis like this. And these things here live in the Lie algebra. These things here live in omega 1p with values in the real numbers. Then if you do this, when you do the wedge of omega with itself, there's going to be this TA wedge this TB, but the matrices here don't care about the wedge. So this would be this wedge, this times this. So in this sense, this wedge product is not going to be zero because we're wedging different entries of the matrices. So not all of them are going to be zero. The reason why we do something like this is that although the thing makes sense, generally speaking, because we're working with forms that have values in the algebra. So if you want to multiply two forms together, we need to make sure that they're still forms and that they're still the algebra elements. So if I take the wedge product of the forms, for the form part, that's good. But in the Lie algebra, the only way we know how to take products is by taking the commutator in a way that we stay inside the Lie algebra. So as it turns out, this is a commutator because this thing is anti-symmetric. So we could write this as 1 half omega A wedge omega B minus omega B wedge omega A. And then we still have TA TB. And so this is now going to be 1 half A wedge omega B TA TB minus TB, TA. So indeed, this multiplies the matrices in such a way that we stay in the Lie algebra, multiplies the forms so that we stay inside the form. So everything is fine here. So to put this notion together more generally, we introduce this kind of product. This is a combination of both the Lie bracket and the wedge product. So in general, this is going to be defined by asking that if these forms are written in this way, then this is exactly omega e wedge omega p and ta db. And so you can see that this is exactly twice as much as the one. So if you put the one off in front, you have this equality within the expressions. At this stage, I cannot really explain why we define the curvature in this specific way, and also why we call it curvature. But it will turn out that if all goes well and I cover everything I want to cover, by the end of the last lecture, we're going to have seen the covariant derivatives associated to a connection. And this tensor is actually measuring the non-commutativity of this derivative. So just like the Riemann tensor measures how much the connection, well, the covariant derivative associated to the metric is non-commuting, this measures the same thing, but for the connection omega. As usual, this is the big picture on the principal bundle, but in physics, we don't really care about the principal bundle. We want to do things locally. We would like this thing to be a field on the manifold. So if Si is a section of P, just like we did last time, which means choice of gauge, then we can just define something we're going to call Fi, which is just the pullback dissection of the curvature form. So these things are called local field strengths. And because of the fact that the pullback preserves both taking wedge products and taking axial derivatives, this is simply going to be dAi plus 1 half. AI, which is the AI plus AI wedge, AI. So we can define these without problems locally. We call it local field strength because it's going to be related to the thing we call field strength for gauge theories. And it should be already clear, I'll give you the example in full later, but if the group is abelian, then this thing is going to disappear because this contains a commutator between the algebra elements, but the Lie algebra elements are going to always commute. So you're only left with this that looks exactly like saying that f equals dA, where A is a one form. So you can think of this as just being the Faraday tensor and A just the four potential. As usual, this is a gauge dependent quantity. In general, in some cases it will not be, simply because I chose a gauge. So if we change gauge, this means that we're going to define fj equals sj star omega. So same idea, but we use aj. Then we may ask, what is the expression that we get for fj in terms of fi? I'm not going to go through the steps because they're actually quite easy, and I put them into this tutorial. So you're just going to do this as an exercise today. But it's not difficult to see. It doesn't require any weird proof. You're just really using the properties of d and the wedge. Fj is going to be tij to the minus 1 fi. Tij, where Tij is the gauge transformation that takes us from one section to the other. So an important thing to note is that this quantity does not have that derivative of Tij thing. So if you look at them like this, these quantities are gauge dependent. So generally speaking, they are gauge dependent, but if G is abelian, then this is actually the same as fi. This is the adjoint action of the group on the Lie algebra, and if the group is abelian, that action is also going to be abelian. Well, it's just going to be a trivial action. This means that if G is abelian, Fi is gauge independent, first of all, and most importantly, can be extended globally. So even though the connection itself, or the local gauge fields, if you're working with a non-trivial bundle, cannot be made global, F can be made global in this case. We simply define a new quantity F, and we say that F equals Fi on Ui, and well, that's it. So restricted to Ui, I guess I should just write it like this. F restricted to Ui is Fi. And then I can patch them together because on the intersection between different patches, they are exactly the same. So I can just patch it together and it's going to be a nice two form defined everywhere. And also one thing to note, well, already said that if it is abelian, then F is also exact because it's going to be D of AI. But it's only locally exact because the AI is not everywhere defined. So these are important things to keep in mind, but we'll go through the example of electromagnetism soon. And the final thing to say about the curvature tensor and the local strength fields is that they satisfy an identity known as Bianchi identity. This again is a simple thing to prove, so you can prove it today at the tutorial. And it's simply something that follows from the definition. Because of the fact that F is defined like this and omega is defined like that, you can just check that in general. I'll give you the global version first and then we'll look at the local representations. If I take the exterior derivative of the curvature tensor and then I add to it these, which order do I put things? The Lie bracket of omega, the connection, and the big omega, the curvature, this is going to be zero. And again, you define this Lie bracket in the usual way, which ends up actually giving you the omega plus, this time is omega wedge omega minus omega wedge, small omega. So this is something that the curvature tensor always satisfies just because of the way it's defined. And locally, because all of these things commute with the pullback, you can just rewrite it as dFi plus AI Fi is zero. So you can think of this as being the equivalent of df equals zero in the case of electromagnetism. When you're looking at just electromagnetism, the gauge group we use is U1, which is commutative. So this Lie bracket is going to disappear and you just get dFi zero. So in general, the curvature tensor is not closed. It is closed if and only if the group is commutative. So generally speaking, it's not going to be a closed thing. So in a sense, this commutator measures how much the form is not closed. And as I mentioned, in the end, this thing is going to be related to the fact that f is the curvature of the covariant derivative. Okay, so that's really everything I had to say about the curvature tensor. Are there any questions? So let's just put things together. These examples are probably things they've already seen anyway. So the first example will be we just take Minkowski space as our manifold, and the bundle is going to be M times U1. So we're going to take the bundle to be trivial. And as it turns out, because we are using this as a manifold, the bundle is necessarily trivial. So if we work with this, then there is a global section. Simply because I can trivialize this everywhere because it's already trivial. The fact that there is a global section means that I can do a global choice of gauge. And so this means that I can define my gauge field as a one form that lives on the whole manifold and has values in U1. I'm going to put underlines when I do Lie algebras just because I cannot really easily do fractal functions. So we can define this globally. And I didn't prove this, and it's not obvious to prove, but we mentioned last time that the local gauge fields fully specify the connection. So this means that if I specify a one form in here, this fully specifies the connection that lives here. So giving a one form here is going to associate something over there. And then I need to transform it, of course, when I change gauge, I need to transform it in the proper way, which is the formula with G A to the minus 1 AG and the G minus 1 DG part. Now, the question, of course, is how do we decide which one to take? Because then any one form is going to work. But we need to make sure that the sum equation is satisfied. So to choose the actual one, we use the equations of motion. So in our case, there would be Maxwell's equations. Because we're going to interpret A as the full potential, F as the field strength. So the equation, say in the absence of charges, will be requiring that this is zero. And the other equation that you usually put, the fact that df equals zero, this one comes for free. This one comes just from the fact that f is the curvature of a connection, but the connection is abelian. So this one is automatically true because f equals dA, f is exact, so it's also closed. And you've probably seen this already, but the reason why it makes sense to use this to describe this particular gauge field is that we require that if we change gauge, then A prime. If A prime is the gauge field in the new choice of gauge, it's going to transform like this. And G is going to be a map that's globally from M to U1. Now, because G is a map that goes from M to U1, then you can think of G as being something that will point u associates e to the alpha I alpha mu, where alpha is a smooth function. And it has real values. And because the group is abelian, this is the same as a plus g to the minus 1 dg. But g to the minus 1 dg is going to be e to the minus I alpha d e to the I alpha. So you get a plus I d alpha e to the minus I alpha e to the alpha. So this disappears and you just get something which is a plus I d or something else. The I thing is quite annoying, and the problem with this is that we chose the unitary group, which means that the algebra U1 is I times R, is all the imaginary numbers. So technically, with this choice, our Gauge field A is imaginary. So is F. So if you want to use this to connect to the physical quantity, you have to multiply everything by either plus I or minus I. This is quite annoying because it means that you either have to deal with this fact and multiply stuff by I, or you need to give different names to the Gauge fields and then the real quantities you call A and F. Either way, it's annoying. I don't know if there's a way to kind of get both things. So we're just going to define it like this, and then when you have things that have to do with U1, you're going to have to make them imaginary. Multiply them by I to make them real, if you want. Any questions about this example, which I assume you will see at some point in some way? So the next example is the magnetic monopole. And those of you taking gravitational physics have this as one of the homeworks, so you've seen it already. Don't worry, this is not going to spoil the homework. I'm not going to actually do any calculations. But I'm just going to explain quickly what's happening. For the magnetic monopole, we're assuming that there is a magnetic monopole, so there is some magnetic charge. So the equations are not going to be just Maxwell's equations. So we're going to assume that we have a Dirac delta-like potential, and the magnetic field is going to end up being something like this. There's some coefficient alpha times r over the norm of r cubed. So we're assuming a Coulomb-like solution for the magnetic field. In terms of differential forms, as you've seen in our homework, we can write B as a differential form by doing bx dy wedge dz plus by dz wedge dx plus bx bz dx wedge dy. We're making it into a two form because you expect this to be a pseudovector, so the two form is the proper way of dealing with it. And now it turns out that if you define this like this, and then you define B in this way, then dB is actually zero, where it's defined, which is on M, which is going to be our manifold, which is, in this case, is R3 minus the origin. We need to remove the origin because this is not defined at the origin. So our manifold now has a point removed, and this is very important because it's going to make, well, it's going to allow the possibility that our bundle is non-trivial. So we're going to interpret, just because we're still doing something which is like electromagnetism, We're going to take our gauge group to be U1. And we're going to take RB to be the equivalent of the curvature. So now what we're going to do is something that I mentioned last time, and that is that I don't need to actually give you the principal bundle. I can give you the gauge fields, tell you the way they transform, and that's going to actually induce the bundle structure. So instead of building the bundle first, I'm going to try to find some gauge fields such that locally, B is the curvature. So I want locally B equals dA. And it turns out that it needs to be a non-trivial bundle because there is no way of doing this globally. B is closed, but it's not exact. I'm not going to prove this. It has to do with taking the integral of this thing. You can show that if you take an integral over the sphere of B, and we didn't really talk about integrations of manifolds, so I cannot really tell you what this means. But two forms, I think, things that can be integrated on surfaces. If we integrate this, we get 4 pi alpha. But if this were exact, then it would actually be zero. So it cannot be exact. So instead of trying to find something global, which cannot be done, we're going to try to find local things and make sure that when we patch them, they transform like a gauge transformation. And those transformations are going to give us the clutching functions, and we use those to build the bundle. So to do things locally, we need to choose at least two patches that cover the whole space. Our patches are going to be U plus is going to be the set. I'm just going to call it, it's our original M, but I'm going to remove some things. So I'm going to remove all of the points that look like 0, 0, lambda, where lambda is negative. So I'm going to remove a half line, everything on the z-axis that goes below 0. And U minus is the same thing, but I'm going to remove the things that are above 0. And if I put them together, the union of U plus and U minus is the whole M, because the things that I'm removing, the other one has. And given this, you can define two fields, A plus minus. So these are going to be U1 valued one forms. So this means they should have imaginary values. So the way I define them is I alpha x dy minus y dx over r z plus minus r. Exactly why you choose these is not obvious. You're trying to find things that satisfy b equals dA. The I is because we want it to be imaginary, alpha is because b is proportional to alpha. And you can check explicitly, and I did it yesterday and it's a pain, but if you want to check it, go ahead, that indeed dA plus minus equals b. If you try to do it on your own, I highly recommend doing Mathematica instead of doing it by hand, because it really is annoying. And also you can see that A plus minus are fully defined on U plus and U minus, because this thing at the bottom, R is, 1 over R is always going to be defined because 0 is excluded. And for the plus 1, zeta plus R is always, it's always going to be greater than 0 because, well, different than 0. Because either there is some x and y component, and then z cannot be the same as r, or x and y are 0, but then r is positive and z must be positive as well because you removed the negative ones. And vice versa, if we are in u minus, then r is going to be positive, z is going to be necessarily negative, and then we do something negative minus something negative is going to be still negative. So these are defined, satisfy these things. The only things that are left to check is that they actually are transforming Lagrange fields. So to check that, we are trying to find out whether A plus equals A minus plus G minus 1 dG. Because the gauge group is U1, so this is the only thing you can get. This would be G to the minus 1, A minus G, but that part doesn't matter. So for this to happen, we're just going to check what A plus minus A minus is. And again, you can easily check just from the definition over there that you're going to get this. And all that's left to do is to find a group transformation G such that G to the minus 1 dG is this thing. And again, I'm not going to prove any of this, but you can check all the steps yourselves. This can be done if we choose the map G to take x, y, z to e to the 2i alpha arctan of y x. That's simply because arctan is going to be the angle between y and x. So that's essentially we're doing polar coordinates here. Well, cylindrical because z is still left as is. So when you do d of this thing, you might have seen this before. This is pretty much the exterior derivative of the angle variable written in terms of x and y. It's not global, but you can do it in two patches, then it looks the same. So you can define the group action like this. You want this to be smooth, and right now, in general, this is not. The reason why this may not be smooth is that this angle is going to go between minus pi and pi. It has a discontinuity, the arctan 2 function, when you reach the negative x-axis, because you are going, if you approach this way, you are approaching minus pi, this way you're approaching pi. So as you cross, you go from pi back to minus pi. But if you're doing e to the I something, that jump doesn't matter as long as the jump is a multiple of 2 pi. So the jump as you go, because you're multiplying the angle by 2 alpha, the jump is only going to be of 2 pi or a multiple of 2 pi if 2 alpha is an integer. So this whole construction works as long as 2 alpha is an integer. So this is the Dirac quantization condition that tells us that because alpha is proportional to the strength of the magnetic field, that if you have a magnetic monopole and you want to write it as a gauge theory and everything be consistent, alpha must be quantized. Yes?
So can we argue that like we picked particular charts that like so we saw in the gravitational homework that like Dirac's string is unobservable. Can we also argue by the fact that like we chose particular string? So like one dimensional sing so like we will have if we pick different charts, we will still have like one dimensional singularities, but like not particular like along the z-axis, right? I can like
Yes. So you can pick different charts.
And the quant
But the point is that although the fields A plus minus have singularities in the sense that they blow up as you approach this, always remember, first of all, that these are not observable.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter as long as B is well defined, and B is well defined at this point. And also, you have a field A defined on the Dirac line, because on the plus line you use a minus, on the minus line you use a plus. So you actually have a gauge field defined at every point in the manifold. It's just not always the same. But this should be expected. The whole thing of you cannot patch together things globally is because at some point you must have something that cannot be done. So you must have some singularity. If there was no singularity, then you could extend A by just patching together things. So this is the only example that I actually know, and that's kind of the common example of something like this. But I would expect the same features to work in general, because there must be something that prevents you from patching things together.
And like, why a quantization result is physical?
Well, it's simply telling you that if you want to treat this as a gauge theory, so you want to use our framework for gauge theories, you must choose, well, and you want A plus minus to be your fields, which means if I choose these things and they transform in the right way, I'm essentially choosing a clutching function. I'm saying the clutching function T plus minus of X, Y, Z is going to be e to the 2y alpha arctan. Well, e tan 2 yx. I'm choosing a clutching function and two open sets, u plus u minus, that cover the whole thing. And I can use these to actually create the bundle. So once I create the bundle, a plus minus are the local gauge representations of the connection. And those uniquely determine the connection. So if I give you this function, this essentially these and these things together, I'm making the bundle and I'm also making the connection. So the statement there about the quantization is that this thing is a clutching function only if alpha is an in alpha times 2 is an integer. Otherwise, this is not going to work. I'm not necessarily proving that this is the only possible connection that you can have, but if I choose the bundle to be defined by this clutching function and these to be the local gauge representations, there's only one connection, and that's the one. And conversely, if I choose these to be my local representations, the clutching function must only exist if alpha times 2 is an integer. So the importance of this example is, well, there's obviously an importance for physics of the existence of a magnetic monopole justifies quantization of charge. But the important thing for gauge theory and principal bundles is that this shows you why it's important to deal with the differential geometry structures that we're talking about, instead of just saying, well, locally just use gauge fields and that's fine. Because this notion of alpha must be quantized follows directly from a topological reason. This thing is global. If you just look at things locally, it doesn't matter. It's only when you try to go all the way around and you encounter the discontinuity that you have a problem. So non-principal bundles, sorry, non-trivial principal bundles are important because they are the ones with interesting topological things. The trivial bundles are trivial, they're just products of manifolds. The non-trivial ones have some kind of topological thing that prevents them from being global. Just like the Mobius band, locally looks like a cylinder, but overall there's something to it that if you just look at a patch of it, there's no way you can get it. So it's something that you need to only look at the big picture global object to be able to really see. So that's the idea of why we care about all these things, because then the study of all these things tells us things about the potential gauge fields that you might get. So this is a simple example, but it's already telling us that if you want to do a gauge theory like this, then you must have a quantization of the magnetic field strength. And things like this are also applicable to other things. If you try to do geometric quantization, things like this happen as well. So those are something that gives you quantization in the same way. There's some topological thing that tells you that you must have some quantity quantized. Yes?
And the reason why this doesn't happen for the electric field is because electric field is a one form.
So the electric field, so in which sense that it doesn't apply to electric field? So you're asking why this doesn't apply for the electric field? Right, so this doesn't happen for the electric field, yes, because the electric field is a one form. So the electric field itself, you cannot think of as being the curvature of a connection. That's the main thing. The way it works, if you're working in three dimensions and exclude everything else, the magnetic field on its own, it's a two form. So you can think of that as being potentially the curvature of a connection. So we're doing some weird connection, which is just on R3, but mathematically speaking, it doesn't matter. It doesn't need to have time. The whole construction that we've done, does nowhere I said that we were working in Minkowski space or Lorentzian manifolds. In fact, I didn't say anything about metrics. All the construction that we've done so far does not actually rely on space-time. So the whole structure works just as well if I use the magnetic field as a two form, and I expect that to be the curvature over one form. And it still makes sense, because if B is closed and I want to write it locally as something exact, the local something exact is gauge dependent, because I need to choose a particular one form. Then when you apply the exterior derivative, it gives you the two form. There's always some ambiguity, because in general, D of A plus D lambda is the same as D A. So that's always going to be true. So that's why we use gauge theory to describe things like F equals D A, because there's that ambiguity in A. So we can think of it, we can think of that ambiguity as being a gauge dependence. And similarly, B is a gauge dependence if we see it this way. Yes?
So just to review again, okay, like Dirac assumed this is like a magnetic monopole. He said like, okay, the underlying principle that is not violated, that like this magnetic field comes from the gauge potential. And also the fact that like in the charge, in the gauge transformation, we just have an electric charge and not the new magnetic charge, that is important assumption as well, right?
I don't know if it matters that you have no magnetic charge at this point, no electric charge, but probably makes things more complicated if you do.
Yeah, because you can have U1 still, but like why just electric charge and not magnetic something?
Yes. Well, we're kind of taking Maxwell's equation. So I came up with this. I just say, well, let's suppose this. But what you're really saying is you're asking that the divergence of B is proportional to a delta function. So that would be one of the equations. So that equation gives you something like that. And then we're also requiring that there is no time dependence. Those are the only two things that are requiring. So if you do this and then say dB over dt equals zero, then as long as these two things are satisfied, you can do whatever you want with the electric field. There is some constraint on the electric field, because one of the equations for the electric field has dB over dt in it. But as long as the equation that E satisfies is consistent with this, then everything I said about B works just as well. So it's not just any electric field, but as long as the electric field satisfies this thing, it's fine. So you could still have an electric charge, and this will still work. Unless, of course, what I just said automatically makes E zero. I'm not entirely sure, but I expect there will be some kind of electric field that will still be fine. You could change, you could have constant electric field and that will just disappear from the equations, for example. Okay, so that's it for the examples. Then the next thing I want to do is setting things up for next time. Because I want to really make sure that I tell you about covariant derivatives, because it's a very cool thing. And also, if I don't tell you about covariant derivatives, that ruins my plan for tutorial. So we need to do that, which means I need to start telling you something now. Any questions before we move to this last part? So the idea is going to be that omega defines a covariant derivative. And that's going to be a covariant derivative in some weird space that's not living on the manifold. But the local fields A define a covariant derivative on vector spaces that transform in the right way. It's very ambiguous here. It's going to be clear in the next lecture. But what I'm trying to say is that if I have some vector space, well, really some vector bundle, put in vector fields. That's what I meant. So to describe vector fields on the manifold so far, we use the tangent bundle because those vectors were attached at each point in the tangent space. But in general, I can have some field which is vectorial in nature, but is not attached on the manifold. So for example, if you want to have something like a scalar field, a complex scalar field that you attach at each point of a manifold, you want to try to describe bosons, that intercharged bosons. Then you will need to have a vector field, because if they live in C or C2 or Cn in general, they are vectorial in nature because that's a vector field. But it's not necessarily attached to the manifold because it doesn't actually care about the geometry of the manifold. At each point, I am associating a complex number. I don't care whether it's tangent to the manifold or not. In fact, it doesn't make sense to ask because it's not a geometric object. And I would like to couple that with the gauge field. So I would like for these things to change as I'm changing the gauge in a specified way. To do this, we're going to need the notion of what is the space where these vector fields live. So I hope this provides enough motivation, and it's not fully unclear. I know it's just I wrote two things and I just said words. But I hope it's just kind of clear what the big picture is. Next lecture, we're going to see the details. And in the 7 or 8 minutes that we have left, I want to start telling you what the space that we're working with is. So this notion is called associated bundle, actually, because we're working with vector bundles, so associated vector bundle. So this is a construction that's actually more general than this. I'm not going to give you the whole general version, but you can actually build other principal bundle. You can build all sorts of other bundles that have the same structure group and the same clutching functions. And in particular, you can build vector bundles out of this. For our purposes, we only care about the vector bundles, so we're just going to look at these ones. So, our ingredients are going to be a principal bundle on a manifold. And then some vector space that's going to be the fiber. And so this is going to be real or complex vector space. So because I'm trying to build a fiber bundle, I want my fiber to be a vector space. And I'm going to take this vector space as the fiber. And finally, because I'm trying to do the construction that we talked about where I give you the clutching functions of the bundle, and those clutching functions should act on the fibers in a linear way, I need a representation of the group. A representation of the group. Have you all seen representations of groups? Okay, I'm going to define them anyway. If it's not clear, please ask me about it. So it's going to be some map that goes from the group to another group, which is usually called either GL of V or out of V. This thing here is the set of all the maps that go from V to V, which are vector space isomorphisms. So essentially, this map is giving us an action of the group on the vector space. For this to be a representation, it needs to satisfy something. This is a group, and this is also a group, because things in there are invertible, and by composing them, it's like multiplying them. They need to satisfy that rho of the identity element acting on a vector v should leave the vector v invariant. And then rho of the product of two elements acting on v should be rho of g acting on H. This property is the fact that rho is a group homomorphism between G and GLD. So in general, if the vector space would just say Rn, then you could just think of this as being to each group element you associate a matrix which is invertible that acts on the vectors just by multiplying to the vectors. So in the case, GLV would just be GLNR, where V is Rn. Okay, so now the reason we're doing this is that if we have a G bundle and a vector V with a representation, which gives us an action of the group on V, then we can build an action, a right action, of the group G on this space. We can build an action on P times V. In this way, if I have a pair PV that lives in here, and I want to act with it from the right with the group element G, I'm going to define this as the pair where I have G acting on P. This is the action from the principal bundle. And then I want a right action on the vectors. On the vectors, I know how to act in the way. And I'm going to define the action as rho of g to the minus 1 acting on V. The reason why I'm acting with the inverse is that now when I compose two actions, if I do rho of g to the minus 1 V, and then I act on the left by rho h to the minus 1. This is rho h to the minus 1 g to the minus 1 V, and this is rho g h to the minus 1 v. So this is like acting from the right with gh. This would be v acting on the right by gh. So this kind of action is actually right action if I use the inverses. So that's why this thing makes sense. And because of this, I can take a quotient. I have a group action. And this is something you can do every time you have some group action. You can always consider the space P times V over G, which is really a quotient with respect to an equivalence relation. So this would be the set of all equivalence classes P, V, such that P is in capital P, V is in capital V, and the equivalence classes are defined in this way. It's going to be the set of all P, V, in which I act with G, such that G is in the group. So I take the action of the group, I take a certain point, and I act with all possible group elements. Everything that I get out of this, I put in the same bucket. And the set of all these buckets is the quotient. So this is a construction that you can always do with group actions. For our purposes, it doesn't really matter. But this is going to be our vector bundle. The vector bundle is going to be P times P over P. And just because you're going to do this a lot, let's give it a name. So the name that people usually use for this is P cross V, and they put a subscript rho to the cross, because it's telling us that the product that we're doing is not just the Cartesian product, it's a product induced by the representation. We don't have time to go through all of the steps now, so we're going to stop here. But this is an important point to note. The representation tells us how the bundle works. So there are two ingredients here, the vector space itself and the representation. Because I could choose the representation to be any kind of representation. And by choosing that, this connects to the fact that I said that the covariant derivative is going to act on vector fields that transform in a certain way. That representation tells us how the vector fields transform under gauge transformations. You could choose it to be trivial, and in that case, the vector fields would be gauge invariant. And if they're gauge invariant, they do not couple with your fields. So they will be just a scalar field, non-charged, that doesn't care about the electric field, for example. Or you could choose the representation that's more interesting, and then you're going to have a charged field, because when you change the electric field, it changes as well. We'll see all the actual examples next time, but this saves us 10 minutes from next time, which is great, because we need that time. Any questions about these so far? I haven't done anything weird yet. I just defined the set. But as we'll see, by using these and the properties of the principal bundle, we can make this in a canonical way into a vector bundle.
Okay, so like the elements of PVG is okay. So P is what, the point in the manifold, and then the fiber, and the G leaves still leaves fiber invariant.
So
point would be pretty much the point at the manifold, and the, all the V's that are traversed by this action.
Kind of. So we're going to have, for each fiber of P, we're associating one of these things, because by acting with G on this thing, we go through the whole fiber.
Whole fiber, yeah.
So all these points are going, each equivalence class is going to essentially contain all points in the fiber and at each point all possible vectors at that point. But you're putting all fibers into here. So this is a weird construction, but it doesn't actually matter. So remember when I told you that P itself, physically, we don't care about it. What we care about is the manifold M, which is controlled by space-time, and the fields on it. Likewise, we don't actually care about this bundle. This bundle, we need it mathematically to work with, but these are not the things we're going to be interested in. Because if you look at sections of this bundle, they are not going to be vector fields on the manifold. They're going to be vector fields on P.
Yeah.
And that's not helpful at all. So instead, we are going to define something where we're going to see that to each section of the principal bundle, we can associate a local vector field on the manifold in such a way that that field transform using the representation rho when we change gauge. So for our purposes, this is not actually important. This is the construction that we need for this to make sense. But physically, we don't actually ever use this. So there is no point in trying to interpret what these things are. They're just really buckets with things inside. They are just needed so that the transformations law are going to be the correct ones.
Okay.